We move on to the topic of sense and reference. What we've seen so far is that a systematic theory of meaning contains two types of clause. So it contains axioms specifying the meanings of basic linguistic components. That is what I've been calling a lexicon. And it will contain grammatical principles, principles of composition telling us how to combine basic units into sentences. Now, the axioms specifying the meanings of basic components specify what theorists call semantic value or reference. So these are two interchangeable pieces of terminology that we introduce at this point because we're now going to try and make the notion of meaning more precise. So far we've been talking about meaning in very general terms. We haven't broken it down into different components, but now we need to do that. So we start off with the notion of reference or semantic value. And the modern notion of reference or semantic value stems from Frege, and much of the current discussion of these notions is still influenced by his treatment of them. Reference is what Frege called Bedeutung. In German, of course, Bedeutung simply means meaning. It pretty much has the same meaning in German as the word meaning has in English. They have very similar ranges of significance. So Frege was commandeering an ordinary German word to use to talk about what was in fact a rather technical notion. And that's why, as I say, modern theorists tend to prefer to use an explicitly technical term like semantic value or a term like reference, which is a word in common use, but in this context, in discussions of theories of meaning, it has a technical meaning, and we'll come to that shortly. So far, the only grip that we have on the notion of reference or semantic value is that it's what a systematic theory of meaning tells you about, and that it is subject to the principles of creativity and compositionality. So the principle of compositionality, for example, might be precisified to talk about reference. So we would say the reference or semantic value of a complex expression is determined in a systematic way by the references, semantic values, of its parts and the manner of their composition. Now, what exactly did Frege mean by reference, Bedeutung? Because he was mainly concerned with scientific language and with natural language only to the extent that it could be made to approximate to scientific language, he concentrated on the meaningfulness of declarative sentences, so that's sentences that have a truth value. And his view was, quite naturally, that science has an overriding concern with truth, with the truth values of sentences that it investigates. Same with mathematics. Partly because of this, he took the reference of an expression to be whatever it is about that expression which goes to determine truth value of sentences in which that expression occurs. So the principle, and I put it down on the handout, is that the semantic value of an expression is that feature of the expression which determines, which goes to determining the truth value of declarative sentences in which it occurs. And Frege took the semantic value of sentences themselves to be their truth values because that was, for him, the crucial semantic notion. The truth value of a sentence was its most important feature, thinking about it from a scientific point of view. And so since he was making the references of subsentential components, so words, to be their contribution to the truth values of sentences in which they occurred, it made sense for him to treat the reference of a sentence itself as its truth value. That was more or less definitional for him. But there was another reason, which was that sentences can, of course, themselves form components of more complex sentences. And again, Frege thought that it was the truth value of a sentence that contributed towards the truth value of more complex sentences in which it occurred. Now, some sentences do occur as parts of other sentences in what we call a truth functional way. That's to say that the truth value of the overall complex sentence is a function of the truth values of its component sentences. This is the kind of compositionality that is studied in standard logic, where you find various what we call truth functional connectives, like and, or, not, if, then. And these connectives are called truth functional because they work in that way. That's to say, the only thing that matters to the truth value of complex sentences containing these connectives is the truth values of the component sentences. The truth value of the complex overall sentence is a simple function of the truth values of the component sentences in a way that is given by the truth tables. The meanings of the component sentences play no role. But of course, many connectives in natural language are not truth functional. The obvious example is the connective because, which requires its two component sentences. So if you have a complex sentence of the form P because Q, the truth of that sentence requires the truth of the two component sentences P and Q, but it requires more than that. It requires Q to be a reason for P. So it's not a purely truth functional connective. More is relevant to the truth value of a sentence of the form P because Q than just the truth values of the components. Their meanings are relevant as well. So it's not a truth functional connective. Now, Frege was in effect ignoring such connectives against his own program, it has to be said, because certainly natural science makes use of the connective because, so it isn't restricted to purely truth functional connectives. So Frege should really have considered them and dealt with them, but he didn't. And this simplified and, as I'm implying, falsified his program to some extent. And it enabled him to say that the truth value of a sentence is that feature of it which goes to determining the truth values of more complex sentences in which it occurs. And as I've been saying, that only applies to truth functional contexts, not to non-truth functional ones. Okay, going back to the reference of parts of sentences rather than sentences themselves, Frege thought that the reference or semantic value of a proper name is the object for which that name stands. And again, one can justify that on the basis that how things are with the object for which the name stands is what matters to the truth value of sentences containing that name. So the object, the bearer of the name, is relevant to determining truth values of sentences containing that name. And if you take a simple predicate, like is green, for example, Frege thought that the reference of that kind of expression was what he called a concept. And he identified a concept with a function from objects to truth values. So in the case of the predicate is green, the function that it refers to would be the one that maps all and only green objects to the value true and everything else to the value false. Now, a simple sentence would be constructed for Frege from a name together with a predicate. So if we go back to one of the examples that we used earlier, Jane is happy was one of our sentences. So that is constructed from the proper name Jane and the predicate is happy. And as I've said, for Frege, the name Jane refers to that person, the person who is the bearer of that name. Whereas the predicate or concept expression is happy refers to, as we've said, what Frege calls a concept, the concept of happiness, and that he in turn identifies with a function from objects to truth values. So it would map all the happy objects in the world onto the value true and everything else onto the value false. And that fits with his approach to reference because you might say, well, it's these two things, namely the bearer of the name, the person Jane, and the concept of happiness. It's these two things that determine the truth value of the whole sentence, Jane is happy. And he set things up so that that result pops out automatically. You simply plug the object into the function and see whether the function maps it onto the value true or onto the value false. So if Jane is among the happy objects in the world, then she will be mapped onto the value true. And that means that the whole sentence, Jane is happy, will be true, and otherwise it will be false. And that also fits with Frege's preferred candidate for sentential reference. So remember, Frege thinks that a sentence, and he's thinking of declarative sentences here, refers to a truth value, true or false. So the reference of the sentence, Jane is happy, is one of those two truth values, depending on whether Jane is happy or not. And that fits immediately with his preferred candidates for a subsentential reference. Because as we've seen, if you plug the object Jane into the function happiness, out pops a truth value. And then that very truth value is the reference of the whole sentence, Jane is happy. So the reference of the sentence is determined by the references of the component parts. And you might say Frege achieved that result in the most obvious way, most direct way possible. But another way of achieving the same effect, but selecting a different entity to be the reference of a sentence, would be the way that, in effect, Russell chose, Frege's contemporary. Russell identified the references of sentences not with truth values, but with basically structurings of the objects and concepts that are the references of the component parts. I mean, he didn't put it like that, but if one thinks of it in Fregean terms, so the reference of the name Jane is the object Jane, the reference of the concept word is happy is the concept of happiness. And for Russell, the reference of the whole sentence, Jane is happy, would be not the truth value you get when you plug that object into that function, but simply a structured set containing that object and that function, side by side, as it were. In the simplest case, you could maybe think of it as just a set containing the object Jane and the function that is the concept of happiness. Now, you might say, well, that achieves as much as Frege achieved, but also a bit more. And what I mean by that is that you've got the object and the concept there in this set, which is the reference of that sentence. And if you plug the object into the concept, into that function, then out pops the truth value. So the truth value is determined by the object and the concept. But instead of simply identifying the reference of the sentence as that truth value, if we identify it, as Russell did, as the object and the concept together in some suitable structuring, maybe as members of a set, then we've got all the same information, as it were, and we've got more because we're working with a more detailed, more informative referent than Frege is. Frege is obliged to say that all true sentences refer to the same thing, namely the value true, and all false sentences refer to the same thing, namely the value false. But on Russell's picture, sentences refer to objects that encode much more of their meaning than sheer truth values would. So for Russell, the reference of a sentence really is an aspect of its meaning, whereas you might say that for Frege, it almost isn't at all, because the truth value of a sentence is a feature of it, but is it a feature of the sentence's meaning? Yeah, I mean, that's not so easy to make out, because, I mean, you might say, well, you don't need to know the truth value of a sentence in order to understand it. So it's not a necessary condition, knowing the truth value of a sentence, to know its meaning. It's not a necessary condition of knowing its meaning, nor is it a sufficient condition. If I just tell you that a sentence in some foreign language which you don't understand is true, that doesn't really get you anywhere towards its meaning. So you might say that Frege's candidate for the reference of sentences, namely truth values, was not really part of a theory of meaning, because truth values are not part of the meanings of sentences. Whereas in Russell's case, the reference of a sentence is at least an aspect of its meaning. I mean, Russell himself went further than that and thought that it was pretty much all of its meaning. That's another question. But at any rate, the way he sets up the references of sentences is such that, as I've said, the references encode at least a great deal of the meanings of a sentence, you know, in an intuitive sense of meaning that I was appealing to a minute ago when I was talking about understanding. You know, if you ask in general what is the meaning of a sentence, it must in some way be correlative with, it must be connected with what you need to grasp if you're to count as understanding that sentence. Right, there's clearly a connection between these notions. And so if you take the sentence, the English sentence, Jane is happy, and you ask, well, what does somebody need to grasp in order to count as understanding that sentence? Well, Russell's reference is a good candidate for what you need to grasp to count as understanding that sentence. It's, as I said, it's some kind of structuring, some kind of entity that, like a set, that contains the object Jane and what Frege would have called the concept of happiness, which he has, we've said, thought of as a function from objects to truth values. That's not how Russell thought of the reference of the predicate is happy. He would have said it was a property and he wouldn't have analysed it in the same way that Frege did. But that's a refinement that we don't need to get into. However we think of this concept stroke property, happiness, that, as it were, Russell and Frege are both agreeing is the reference of the predicate is happy. The fact is that Russell is putting that entity into the reference of the whole sentence along with the object Jane. So that, in effect, he's saying somebody who understands that sentence grasps that complex object, the one that consists in a structuring of the object Jane and the concept or property of happiness. You need to, in some sense, think of, grasp in thought, that complex entity in order to count as understanding that sentence. That's what's going on, or at least that's one thing that's going on when you understand that sentence. So Russell's candidate for sentential reference really is a move in the construction of a theory of meaning. It really is offering us something that you can plausibly take to be the meaning, or at least a very significant aspect of the meaning of a sentence. Whereas Frege's candidate, as we've said, namely truth values, seems to encode much less information and is arguably actually irrelevant to the meaning of a sentence. So you might say that Russell's candidate gives us a much less crude reference or semantic value for the sentence than Frege's candidate. While still encoding all the information that Frege's candidate does encode, at least if you think of, I mean, as I say, in fact, Russell himself didn't, but if we help ourselves to Frege's notion of concept, namely as this function that maps all objects in the world onto either the true or the false, depending on whether they satisfy the predicate or not, if we think of the concept of happiness in that way, then the set containing Jane and that concept of happiness, does determine the truth value of the whole sentence, even though the whole sentence, Jane is happy, even though we're not, as it were, explicitly putting that truth value into the reference or making it the reference, indeed, as Frege did. We're not, that the reference, as it were, doesn't directly encode that truth value, if you like, but it does implicitly because the truth value is just a result of plugging the object into the concept. Now, if you'd said to Frege, look, your candidate for sentential reference, namely truth values, doesn't seem to have very much to do with meaning. It doesn't seem to be relevant to meaning. It's not the sort of thing you need to know if you're to know the meaning of a sentence. I think Frege would have agreed, because Frege had a further conception of meaning, which he called sense. And he would have said, well, I'm encoding all the things that are relevant to meaning, at least the meaning of scientific sentences, at that level, at the level of sense. Russell didn't recognise Frege's level of sense. He rejected it. So that he was, in effect, obliged to encode everything that was relevant to meaning at the level of reference. He really only had the level of reference. So, of course, he had to select entities to be the reference of expressions, which are such that grasping those entities, thinking of those entities, would be what understanding the linguistic item consisted in. So you had to pick plausible candidates for that. But as I say, Frege wanted to make the level of sense the place where everything that is relevant to meaning goes on, as it were. And the level of reference is just relevant to truth value. So he wouldn't have been worried by the fact that the truth values of sentences don't seem to encode anything that is relevant to meaning. So in the case of sentences, just to round that out before I look directly at his justification for introducing sense, Frege thought that sentences referred to truth values, and they did so via thoughts, and these were entities at the level of sense, and they were complex, structured entities that would encode everything that was relevant to meaning. So they would, as it were, do the same kind of work in a theory of meaning as Russell's references of sentences were supposed to do. Okay, well, we need to say something about Frege's justification for introducing the level of sense. I mean, I've implied a justification, but that wasn't, in fact, the one that he offered. So if you want to take a break, now is a good point at which to pause the lecture. Okay, what was Frege's justification for introducing the notion of sense? Well, at the beginning of his essay on sense and reference, Über Sinn und Bedeutung, sometimes that's translated on sense and meaning, he explains his motivation for introducing the notion of sense as well as reference. And that is that he thinks that we need the notion of sense to explain why certain sentences are informative, and he's thinking particularly of identity sentences. So what he says is that if you take an identity sentence which uses the same name on each side of the identity sign, so on the handout this would be a sentence of the form 1, A equals A, Frege thinks, well, that's not informative, that doesn't tell you anything you don't know. Whereas if you have different names on each side of the identity sign, So sentence 2, A equals B. Frege says that can be informative. It can represent a valuable extension of our knowledge. And the example that he gives is that of the discovery that the planet Venus, which is seen both in the morning and in the evening, is indeed the same planet each time. So the Babylonian astronomers discovered that this planet which appeared in the morning was the same one as the planet which appeared in the evening. So, for example, it was a substantial discovery by the Babylonians that the planet Hesperus, which appears in the evening, is the same as the planet Phosphorus, which appears in the morning. I've just used the Latin names there. They would, of course, have had different names, but they would have started off with two names. So it's convenient just to use two names to get the problem going. So if we think of the planet that they observed in the evening, if we call that Hesperus, and the one they observed in the morning, call that Phosphorus, as the Romans did, then what they discovered was that it was the same planet each time, the planet Venus, in fact, as we call it. And so Frege's thought is that before the discovery of this identity, the Babylonians knew that Hesperus is Hesperus, so sentence 3 on the handout. But they didn't know that Hesperus is Phosphorus, that's sentence 4. That was a discovery, and it was not trivial. It was a real advance in their knowledge. Okay, so what Frege is saying is that there's an informational difference. There's a difference in epistemic value, as you might put it. In fact, that was how he put it. Erkenntniswert is the German expression, which translates as epistemic value. And that was the expression that he used. And he said there's a difference in epistemic value between 3, Hesperus is Hesperus, which is trivial, he said, and 4, Hesperus is Phosphorus, which is not trivial, which significantly advanced astronomical knowledge at that time. So, given that these sentences differ in epistemic value, they cannot have exactly the same meaning, he reasoned. But if the only notion of meaning that we had was reference, then they would have the same meaning, because the reference of the name Hesperus is exactly the same as the reference of the name Phosphorus, namely that planet, the planet Venus as we call it. So that in effect you'd be saying Venus is Venus with both sentences, if that were the only aspect of meaning, the reference. You'd be pointing at the same object twice in each of those two sentences, 3 and 4. So, reasoned Frege, reference can't be the only aspect of meaning. We need to register another aspect of meaning to distinguish the meanings of 3 and 4. At the referential level, they're the same. Their parts have the same references, pairwise. But if we distinguish between the senses of the names Hesperus and Phosphorus, then we can say that sentence 4, Hesperus is Phosphorus, associates two different senses with the same object, whereas sentence 3, Hesperus is Hesperus, doesn't. And Frege is assuming that each occurrence of the name Hesperus in that sentence has the same sense, so that it is just repetitive. Whereas in the case of sentence 4, the two names have different senses, so that you're not simply repeating yourself when you use a different name. You're introducing a new aspect. And he called that mode of presentation. So he thought of sense as mode of presentation of an object. And his idea was that the name Hesperus presents the planet Venus in a different way from the name Phosphorus. And indeed, these Roman names are quite useful in that respect because they have literal meanings. I mean, Hesperus means evening star, Phosphorus means morning star, light bearer, literally. Actually, these are Greek names originally, I should say, just to complicate things a bit unnecessarily. But I'm using the Latin forms of the names, but the Romans got them from the Greek. But anyway, the point is that the two names present the planet Venus in different ways, either as an evening appearance or as a morning appearance. And so putting them together in an identity statement and saying that Hesperus is phosphorus can be informative, because although you're pointing at the same object twice, that was the way I put it before, you're doing so from different directions, as it were, down different vistas. You're saying that that, pointing at the morning appearance of Venus, is the same as that, and second time you're pointing at its evening appearance. You know, you could imagine a very long sentence. You could imagine a sentence that took a very long time to utter. You start off in the morning and you say that, and then in the evening you say, is that? And each time you point at the planet Venus, but it's appearing in different parts of the sky. That was the reason, of course, why people were fooled. It appears in different parts of the sky at these different times. And it disappears during the day, obviously. So we're not able to, as it were, with the naked eye, trace its path. So you're actually saying something interesting and informative. You're identifying an object again, but it's an object that presents two different appearances. So it's easy to think that, in fact, it's two objects, when in reality it's only one. So an analogy that I sometimes use is of an art gallery. Suppose you go into an art gallery and you see a sculpture in the first room, and you look at it from one direction, and then you go around the exhibition and you approach it from another direction. So you see a different aspect of the sculpture the second time round. Well, you might not initially realise that it was the same object because you're looking at it from two different directions. You've got two different vistas on it. And you might then discover with a flash of illumination, oh yes, that's the sculpture I saw before. And one way you could put that to yourself would be to say something like, oh, that sculpture is that sculpture. And each time you use the phrase that sculpture, you think of it down a different vista, as it were. First time you use that phrase, you think of it in the way that you first saw it when you came into the art gallery, from the front, say. And the second time you use the phrase that sculpture, you think of seeing it from behind as you approach the end of the exhibition. So you've got two different modes of presentation on the same object, and it can be a matter of discovery to you that they do indeed home in on the same object. Incidentally, I'll just mention in passing an interesting point, which is that example shows that the names don't have to be different for Frege's point to hold. So although I've been following what Frege says, and he says that a sentence like three is trivial, Hesperus is Hesperus, you can actually imagine circumstances in which it wouldn't be trivial, in which the two occurrences of the name Hesperus were associated with different modes of presentation, just like the phrase that sculpture in my art gallery example. And then three would be, or could be, informative. We'd in effect have to split that word into two separate names with different modes of presentation, homing in on the same object. So the matter is a bit more complicated than just names are not simply individuated here by orthography. So sense is a mode of presentation of reference. If you like, it's a route to reference. And there can be different routes to the same referent, as the Hesperus phosphorus example shows. You can have different names with different senses, all homing in on the same object. And in the case of the sentence, Frege would have said, so going back to the point I raised earlier, if you said to Frege, look, making truth values the reference of sentences isn't very helpful if we're trying to ask what the meaning of a sentence is. Truth value doesn't seem relevant. Frege would have said, well, I've packed everything that is relevant to meaning into the level of sense. So the thought expressed by a sentence, which is, we can now say, a mode of presentation of a truth value, that thought contains what we would intuitively think of as the meaning of the sentence. Understanding the sentence is a matter of grasping the thought associated with it, which presents a truth value. And so for Frege, understanding is a matter of grasping the sense of an expression. So in the case of a sentence, it's a matter of grasping the thought that is expressed. In the case of a subsentential expression, like a proper name or a predicate, it's a matter of grasping the sense of that expression. So the sense of the name or the sense of the predicate. And those senses, again, present their references. And they do so in a certain way. They are the way in which the reference gets presented. And Frege, because he was packing, as it were, meaning into the level of sense, he thought, and this next move is not at all compulsory, and we'll see that more recent philosophers don't take it, but he thought that, in fact, you didn't need to grasp the reference of an expression in order to understand it. So he was, as it were, splitting the levels of sense and reference between the two functions that we've been talking about, determining truth value, which was the one we started off with. That all goes on at the level of reference. At the level of sense, what goes on is everything you need to know in order to count as understanding the expression. So in understanding a linguistic expression, you grasp its sense, full stop. That's what understanding is. Its sense, in fact, presents a reference, and that reference is what is relevant to determining the truth values of sentences in which the expression occurs. But you don't need to grasp that reference, according to Frege. You don't need to think of it in order to count as understanding the expression. You just need to grasp the sense. And even though the sense presents the reference, it doesn't take you to the reference in the sense that in order to count as grasping that sense, you have to think of that reference. This is a point on which we'll see that more recent philosophers, or some more recent philosophers, have disagreed. But we'll leave that till next time. At the moment, we'll stick with Frege's position, which is that understanding an expression is a matter of grasping its sense. And you don't have to think of the reference. The reference goes to determining truth values of sentences in which the expression occurs, but that's an entirely different matter, according to Frege, not relevant to understanding. Everything that's relevant to understanding is, as I've said, packed into the level of sense. And of course, going back to the sentences 3 and 4, his solution to the informativeness problem, which was how can 4 be informative when 3 isn't, is that if understanding is a matter of grasping senses, then it's clear that 3 and 4 differ in their senses, because 4 contains 2 different names which have different senses, so the sentences as a whole will have different senses, will express different thoughts. So in entertaining the thought expressed by 3, Hesperus is Hesperus, you're not doing the same thing as you are when you entertain the thought expressed by the sentence 4, Hesperus is Phosphorus. And so the fact that 3 is trivial, that you can, if you understand it, you automatically know that it's true, Frege thought, that doesn't apply to 4. You can understand 4 without automatically knowing that it's true. And indeed, that was presumably what initially happened when the discovery was made. Probably some people contested the discovery and said, oh no, it's 2 different planets, the morning star and the evening star. So they would have, these people would have understood the sentence 4 or their Babylonian equivalent of it, Hesperus is Phosphorus. They would have understood that sentence fine, but they would have denied that it was true. And that would have been possible because the two names differ in sense. So Frege has a principle, which I've put down on the handout as the principle of sense without reference, which is that it's possible to grasp the sense of an expression without knowing or thinking of its reference, its semantic value. As I've said, everything that's relevant to understanding is encoded at the level of sense. You don't need to grasp the referent of an expression or think of it in any way in order to count as understanding that expression. And Frege applied that point to what we call empty names, that's to say names that don't have a bearer. Now, Frege included fictional names under that rubric, which is a controversial move, but he certainly thought that fictional names, that's to say, names used in fiction of fictional characters, he thought that these names have sense but no reference. They don't have reference at all. So it's not merely the case that you don't need to know what the reference is. They actually don't have references. And I think he would have said the same about names in science that turn out to be empty. So science sometimes posits entities that in fact turn out not to exist. So a famous example that people always use at this point is of the planet Vulcan, which was posited to exist in the 19th century in order to explain certain curious features of Mercury's orbit. In fact, in due course, these features of Mercury's orbit were explained by relativity theory, but before that came along, the suggestion was made by Le Verrier, in fact, French astronomer who discovered Neptune, that there was a planet between Mercury and the Sun, which we couldn't see because of its proximity to the Sun, but it was there, and its gravitational pull was affecting Mercury's orbit in a way that would explain the curious perturbations that astronomers had observed in Mercury's orbit. Le Verrier had scored notable success with Neptune, incidentally. He was the astronomer who discovered Neptune, and he worked out its position. He worked out where it had to be from its gravitational effects on Uranus. And when people trained telescopes on that very point, they saw it. You can't see Neptune actually with the naked eye. You can only see it through a telescope. But people hadn't discovered it, hadn't noticed it, until Le Verrier came along and worked out where it had to be. So this is quite a coup, and he tried to repeat that coup, as it were, with Vulcan. Unfortunately, there is no planet Vulcan. It doesn't exist. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we nowadays explain the curiosities of the orbit of Mercury using relativity theory. But at any rate, the existence of this planet was posited. It was called Vulcan. So there you have a case of an empty name. We're talking now about a scientific context, not a fictional one. So the name is introduced, used by scientists to apparently talk about a planet, but the name doesn't have a bearer. There is no planet there. And now, I don't think Frege discusses this particular example, but he discusses other similar ones. He would have said, well, the name does have a sense. It just doesn't have a reference. And indeed, some more recent philosophers have said that as well. So we can understand the name. That's a matter of grasping its sense. It's just that the name doesn't present any object. There's no planet at the end of the mode of presentation, as it were. I'm putting it in that slightly cheeky way, if you like, because I'm anticipating an objection I'll make to this way of thinking in the next lecture, which is that it involves thinking about a mode of presentation as possibly presenting nothing. Right, so you've got to, if you're thinking of the name Vulcan as having a Fregean sense, which is supposed to be the mode of presentation of an object, but in this particular case it so happens there's no object there, then you have to think of this mode of presentation, as it were, as being a route to nowhere, a presentation that presents nothing. And that's a problematic idea, I think. But as I say, I'll come back to that next time. Okay, and Frege extended the sense reference distinction to predicates as well as names, and indeed to sentences, as we've said. You can set up exactly the same puzzle as the Hesperus-Phosphorus one in the case of predicates. So if you look at the handout, sentences 5 and 6 is a predicate version of the Hesperus-Phosphorus puzzle. So you have two predicates, or concept expressions, woodchuck and groundhog. They refer to the same sort of animal. So you can have two different identity statements. Woodchucks are woodchucks, and woodchucks are groundhogs. And Frege would say, well, 5, woodchucks are woodchucks, is trivial. That doesn't advance anyone's knowledge. Whereas 6 is potentially informative. You could imagine a situation, I don't know, you could set up a sort of Hesperus-Phosphorus situation in which somebody encountered woodchucks, I don't know, in one national park in the US and learnt the name woodchuck. Then they went to another part of the US and encountered the same sort of animal, but there it's called groundhog. And initially they don't realise that woodchucks are groundhogs. That's something that this person comes to realise. So the sentence expressing that identity wouldn't be trivial. It would advance your knowledge. So as I say, that's exactly parallel to the Hesperus-Phosphorus situation, and that is Frege's basic justification for introducing the notion of sense in the first place. He finds other uses for it, but his initial justification for the introduction of sense is that it's needed to solve the informativeness puzzle, such as we talked about in the case of Hesperus and Phosphorus, and again, I've given you an example with predicates. And indeed, I think, although I won't go into this, that versions of the informativeness puzzle can arise for other linguistic kinds of linguistic expression as well, not just names and predicates. I mean, clearly it can arise for whole sentences, that's implicit in both examples, but I think also for connectives and other sorts of word. Okay, if you look at the end of the lecture notes or at the bottom of the handout, you see that I've reproduced a map that Frege drew for the philosopher Husserl in a letter to him in 1891, explaining his semantic system, as it were. On the top line, you've got, top left-hand corner, you've got the declarative sentence, which is composed of, and he's thinking here about the simplest kind of example, composed of a proper name and a concept word or a predicate. Then at the next line, you have the level of sense. So you have the sense of a sentence, which he called a thought. Sense of a proper name, sense of concept word. And then the bottom line is the level of reference. You have the reference of the sentence, which we said is a truth value. And that is a function of the references of the proper name, which is an object, and of the concept word, namely a concept. And those vertical arrows connecting the different rows mean present in a semantic sense. And the level of sense is where he's locating meaning, as I've said, and the level of reference is presented by the level of sense, but it's no longer a level of meaning, it's a level of what affects truth values. And you notice that he's got a little horizontal arrow at the bottom right-hand corner connecting the referent of the concept word, that's to say the concept, horizontal arrow to object or objects, we might say, falling under the concept, what logicians nowadays call the extension of a predicate, the objects that it is true of. And it's interesting, we'll say more about this next time, that he doesn't make the object or objects that the predicate is true of, he doesn't make them the reference of the predicate. Some other philosophers have done that historically, and still do indeed. But Frege himself does not do so. He has this sort of dogleg structure in which the connection with the objects falling under the predicate is indirect. The predicate doesn't refer to, and it doesn't in any sense mean, the objects that fall under it. They have a kind of accidental connection, as it were, to the sense and reference of the concept word. Okay, well, I will leave the matter there, and we will continue next time with further developments of the sense-reference distinction.